Justice, this will never go away.
I need people in law enforcement to stand up and say, look, yeah, I'm a good cop, and this is not a good cop. Because if they don't say that, then we can't tell the difference. Their silence makes them complicit.
Any consideration of the impact of mass incarceration that fails to take into account the role of institutionalized racism is an insufficient analysis. And any remedy that does not acknowledge the understanding that racism manifests in various forms is deficient. It is past time that we confront the disastrous policies of the past half century.
And welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, this has been a week of state violence, rage, and mourning. A triangle of police killings from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to St. Paul, Minnesota, to New York City. And then last night, five Dallas police officers shot to death and six others seriously injured by what is believed to be at least two snipers. Today, we have a panel including civil rights attorney LaToya Francis, the Reverend Graylin Hagler, and Scott Roberts of Color of Change, who will join us. And also words of encouragement to the next generation of freedom fighters for legal justice. So as always, a jam-packed show starting with our headlines. Protests and acts of civil disobedience continue nationally in a reaction to the controversial killing by police of two black men in less than a 48-hour period. Alton Sterling was shot several times at point-blank range early Tuesday morning while pinned to the ground by two white police officers, Blaine Salamone and Howie Lake II, outside a Baton Rouge, Louisiana convenience store. On Wednesday night near St. Paul, Minnesota, Philando Castile was shot to death after being stopped for a busted taillight. Both murders were captured in graphic videos that quickly went viral by news organizations and on social media. In addition to protests in Baton Rouge and Minnesota, actions also spread to dozens of cities, including Oakland, California, where hundreds gathered last night, to Ferguson, Missouri, to New York City, and to Philadelphia, where protesters were arrested after blocking rush hour traffic by lying down across Interstate 676. In D.C. Thursday night, area residents gathered at WPFW's Town Hall, From Anger to Action, held in conjunction with Plymouth Congregational Church in Northeast D.C. Mark Richardson was one of those who spoke at the town hall.
I need people in law enforcement to stand up and say, look, yeah, I'm a good cop, and this is not a good cop. Because if they don't say that, then we can't tell the difference. Their silence makes them complicit.
More on the next phase in the movement for black lives after headlines with our panel. Now, there are two major actions happening in D.C. right now impacting education and black farmers. A coalition of farmers are gathered in front of the Supreme Court seeking relief for what they say is continuing and unremitting discrimination from the United States Department of Agriculture. They say that key portions of the historic 2007 Pickford versus Glickman settlement designed to compensate black farmers for a century of discrimination has not been enforced. For example, they say black farmers are continuously denied due process, in particular, a right to have a formal hearing on the merits of their case before the administrative law judge of the USDA. The complaint at the Supreme Court is regarding Eddie and Dorothy Wise, farmers from North Carolina who were foreclosed on and evicted from their 106-acre farm on January 20th of this year by 14 militarily armed federal marshals and several Nash County, North Carolina deputy sheriffs without ever being granted a hearing. The Wises are challenging the USDA's longstanding practice of denying black farmers a formal hearing before the administrative law judge. The 2007 Pickford remedy was enacted to provide the mechanism for a formal hearing on the merits and a moratorium relief until such hearing has been provided. Protesters say that illegal tactics by the USDA are currently affecting more than 80,000 socially disadvantaged farmers. Now over to the Lincoln Memorial, the People's March for Public Education and Social Justice is scheduled to get underway. A broad coalition of teachers and community organizations from around the country are meeting and rallying at the Lincoln Memorial this morning to support public schools and public education. Organizers say that they are rallying and meeting with lawmakers in the coming days to support full equitable funding for all public schools, safe racially just schools and communities, community leadership and public school policies, professional diverse educators for all students, child-centered culturally appropriate curriculum for all, and no high-stakes standardized testing. Tomorrow, the coalition will be holding a conference at Howard University. The website for the gathering is saveourschoolsmarch.org. And a D.C.-based group is also organizing to save a public resource. The Save McMillan Park Coalition hosted a gathering at the historical site along North Capitol and Northwest D.C. to reinforce their effort to save the park from a massive development that would include big box stores and condominiums. Daniel Walkoff, an organizer with Save McMillan Park, said that the organization is fighting to save green open space and the historical significance of the park, which also includes historic underground sound filtration galleries.
This McMillan has been the biggest waste of our tax dollars in the tens and tens of millions. A beautiful green space has been restricted from the enjoyment of the community for 30 years. What do they have to do? They're passing laws as they go along. They're giving these developers a waiver of any bidding process. They've extended the surplusing is the giveaway of the land. They've extended that for 7 years. I mean, they're just saying, we don't care what it takes. We're going to transfer this land to the developers. And where this party today shows a community that's still energized, engaged, connecting up, and Friends of McMillan.org, McMillan Coalition for Sustainable Agriculture.org, and DC for Reasonable Development.org. All three are active together, and we're moving through the courts. I'm very confident now how this development scandal is so made on a pile of jelly that it's just not going to stand.
One idea of the Save McMillan Park Coalition is to utilize a portion of the existing park for urban aquaponics farming, which would generate food and jobs. Now in our culture and media moment, opening in theaters here in D.C. and nationally today is Alex Gibney's critically acclaimed documentary Zero Days about cyber warfare, the development of the Stuxnet virus by the United States and Israel, and the capacity of manipulated computer code to be a doomsday technology, capable of destroying infrastructure such as nuclear plants and power grids. If we needed anything else this week to take us further down into the dumps. Also, the Smithsonian Folklife Festival continues through Monday on the National Mall with an emphasis on Basque culture and California. Also on Monday, WPFW is honoring Amrio Brown, who operated Bohemian Caverns Jazz Club on historic U Street. Monday's program will begin at 7 p.m. at the Bethesda Blues and Jazz Supper Club, 7719 Wisconsin Avenue in Bethesda. For more information, go to WPFWFM.org or call 202-588-0999. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, a new urgency to mobilize in the movement for Black lives. Stay with us. That was Chicoria Home Universe on the ground, on the groundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam. Well, protests and acts of civil disobedience continue nationally in reaction to the controversial killing by police of two black men in less than a 48-hour period. With me to discuss this new urgency to organize in the face of these horrific killings is LaToya Francis, a civil rights attorney based in Baltimore, and Scott Roberts of Color of Change. Good morning, LaToya.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Good morning, LaToya. And also Scott Roberts of Color of Change. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with you, Scott. But please give me your reaction to what's unfolded in the past 3 days. What looks like two cold-blooded murders, really, by police officers this week. And also what happened in Dallas last night. The latest count is that five police officers have been killed.
Yes, I think it's clear we've had three very tragic events. Another reminder of the types of violence that are so prevalent in American society. Obviously, we see video after video and read story after story of police violence, especially in black communities and against black people. And we continue to see this pattern of active shooters, you know, doing these types of attacks. I think I have a lot more clarity about, and I think all of us have more clarity about the two police killing incidents, and that is because of the courage of folks who have taken the actions to videotape police mm-hmm. incidents and confrontations. Mm-hmm. And without that, and without the protests that we saw on the ground in Louisiana and Minnesota, I don't think, you know, we would even be, unfortunately, talking about the losses of the lives of these brothers. Last night, I think, you know, I stayed up to like 3 in the morning last night. And
that was also, right.
Right, yes, the story was changing every 30 minutes.
Right.
To this point, we still don't know anything about the one gunman that the police have said that they killed, or the three folks that they have in custody. We don't know.
Actually, the last report I heard was that they said it's a self-inflicted gun wound. That's what the police report is right now.
But this is exactly my point. Thank you. Because I just saw the mayor announce in a press conference that they sent in a robot and blew the guy up. Sorry for like the kind of violent imagery there, but.
No, yeah, well, the first report was that the suspect has been neutralized. And I thought, what a strange mm-hmm. term. So that makes sense.
So I think that we have so much to learn about Dallas, and we don't really know that much. And it's reminiscent of, to me, it's more reminiscent of active shooter situations like Orlando than anything. But I think what's really important right now is that with Dallas, unfortunately, reinforces a kind of steady myth, or frankly a lie, that the police and their apologists, police unions, other folks have been telling about our movement. They've tried to paint it as violent. They have played on this American tradition of criminalizing and painting black folks as innately violent to portray the movement as violent, to the point where they have been moving legislation to protect police against protesters. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that maybe perhaps just like one person whose motivations still are not fully clear.
And who was not even connected with the peaceful protests, who was up in a high building parking garage. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Just to finish the point, unfortunately, the opposition, folks who don't want to see police reform, don't want to see communities having accountability from police, and control over them, who don't want to see resources moved from policing to community services, the things that the movement wants, those folks don't care about the facts, right? They've been saying we had a national crime wave, that police violence against police was up when those things weren't true. So we know that they're going to try in this moment to change the conversation. They want us to forget about the police killings that we saw on video this week. And they're going to want to put the focus and put the blame on the movement. And I think all of us who still want to see the outcomes from the movement that we've been fighting for
for justice.
Happy People Village, I guess that. Yep.
Right. Now, LaToya, as these three men, and I say three men because in addition to Alton Sterling and Mr. Castillo in Minnesota, there was another shooting in Brooklyn at the start of the week, and that's kind of being left out of most of the narratives I hear. So as these deaths occurred this week, the trial began for Baltimore Police Lieutenant Brian Rice for his role in the death of Freddie Gray. So in this moment, almost 2 years after the murder of Mike Brown, we witnessed this wide range in the progress of these cases, from not even an indictment of Darren Wilson, who chased and killed Mike Brown, to actual indictments and charges brought in Baltimore. So I'm wondering, from your perspective as a lawyer and also as a member of the community in Baltimore, what you think is important for us to think about, both from a legal and community perspective, as police officers continue to kill us and as the community like searches for answers.
Certainly, certainly. And I can appreciate the question at heart. What should we be thinking about? Baltimore, again, is a kind of a microcosm of what should be happening. And in Baltimore, while there are certainly the trials ongoing for the murder of Freddie Gray, and as you know, Lieutenant Brian Rice has started this past week, we demand form over substance. And so what I think we should all be thinking about from, unfortunately, when these homicides happen, what must we be doing as a community to make sure that the mayors are, that the commissioners are involved, that the police chiefs are involved in assisting in these prosecutions? Because folks tend to forget these young men are victims of crime. Their families are survivors of homicide. And just like anyone else who has a family that is now rendered a survivor of homicide, you expect charges, you expect prosecution. You expect the process to go forward and that you be treated with dignity and respect. And so at the end of the day, we want to be sure that we keep the pressure up, that we keep the social media up, that we keep the mainstream media up, so that these police departments do not have the opportunity to change the way in which these killings are changed, the way that they are viewed in the public eye. I agree 110%. We cannot allow the focus and the conversation to be shifted to something such as what did the victims do wrong or what's going on in Dallas. While it is important to address what's going on in Dallas, it is more important at this stage to make sure that the Sterlings and that the Castiles are not forgotten.
I want to play a clip, actually, because you mentioned the family and the victims and the loved ones. So I wanted to play a short clip we have of Lavish Reynolds, who partnered to the Mr. Castillo, who was killed in Minnesota.
I will not be able to sleep until I get justice. I need justice. I need peace. I want justice. I want peace. I want justice. And even after justice, this will never go away.
In addition to being a witness to her partner being killed, shot to death by the police officer, that her 4-year-old daughter was in the back seat of the car. And from what have you seen from your perspective in Baltimore about how, not only how the victims of these shootings have been treated, but how their family members have been treated?
Well, unfortunately, more often than not, the victims and the witnesses are treated like suspects. And just as you've seen in a Mr. Castile situation, his significant other was, in fact, detained, handcuffed, denied information, denied the dignity and respect. And I understand that every jurisdiction doesn't have what we have in the state of Maryland. The Maryland Crime Victims Resource Center, while we are a national organization, we assist in victims' rights. We assist in all victims' rights, court companionship, financial assistance, legal assistance to these victims. We must not allow the victims and the witnesses to be treated like suspects. And again, not only if we allow that, does that give the police department an opportunity to shift the focus from the true crime, creating the survivors of homicide, but we do an injustice to what our system is built to provide, which is the form and the substance, but allowing the process to go forward and allow the process to go through. The last thing we need is a situation like Mr. Castile, for his significant other to be exhausted by the process, for his significant other to be drained and disillusioned by the process. But as we rally around her, as we continue to play her voice, and as we continue to hear her cry, we will, if not shame them into doing the right thing, we will see to it that his family is treated with dignity and respect and all the rights that victims of crime are entitled to. And while I do criminal defense work, certainly you know I am a civil rights attorney. Much of my practice is bringing civil actions against these entities that are responsible. The officers responsible, the police department's responsible, the municipality's responsible. And one of the many things that I have to do and that my office does do is we guarantee that these victims of crime and the witnesses of crime are not simply swept under the rug and treated such as, if they're needed, we use them. If they're not needed, we don't use them. So what we must do is we must make sure that everyone that is considered a victim or a witness of crime, especially to these police brutality cases, be treated with the dignity and respect that the law, in fact, requires they be treated with.
And before we kind of leave the issue of Baltimore, what's happening there, what is your opinion? Why have Baltimore prosecutors been unsuccessful so far in their cases against officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray? And will these cases hamper other cases in the future, do you think?
If you don't mind, I'll take your last question first. Will they hamper other cases in the future? Certainly not. Baltimore is fortunate enough to have a prosecutor that has the integrity and the power behind her and the community behind her to move forward on criminal cases that she believes she has the right to move forward on. We all have heard of prosecutorial discretion, and she's using that prosecutorial discretion. She's using that prosecutorial discretion to move forward and get justice for Freddie Gray. Now, what should we expect? What should be happening around the country is exactly what you see in Baltimore. You should see prosecutors moving forward and holding these officers accountable. One of the points that I've always spoken on when we talk about police brutality or excessive force, or as I say, homicide by cops, is the standard that each of these officers are held to across the nation. The question is, and the Supreme Court has dealt with it, was the officer's use of force objectively reasonable at the time in question? Not what did the officer subjectively feel. Not what did the officer, what can he create in his mind? How can we spin the fact after the fact? Was the officer's conduct objectively reasonable? Now, with regard to the trials that have gone forward and resulted in either an acquittal or a hung jury, as you know, Porter's trial was a trial by jury, and the jurors simply could not conclude unanimously. And so he had a hung jury, and the state is going to move forward with another prosecution as supporter. But what I find was lacking, and again, it's not a criticism of Marilyn Mosby, but it is a criticism of the process in and of itself. Marilyn Mosby's office treated their witnesses as if they misunderstood these officers' roles and the dedication that they have to one another over the process. They put so much energy into the credibility of these officers as if they didn't understand that these officers don't exactly tell the truth when they get on the stand when it comes to talking about their own conduct. And they're not ready to indict their own body. They're not ready to turn the table and look at the Commissioner Bass's or Commissioner Davis's. They're not ready to stand up and say, you know what, I wasn't trained properly, or the education and training didn't cover this, or I've had complaints against me before, and I'm going to allow them to sweep it under the rug and still stay on the patrol and still stay on the beat. They're not willing to say that. So the fact that the prosecutor's office presented their case in each of these cases as if they could rely on the credibility of these officers as their key witnesses is a mistake that a rookie attorney would make. And so hopefully as we go forward with Lieutenant Brian Rice, I could see the strategy changing just a bit. The state's attorney's office for Baltimore City is relying less on the credibility of these officers. You've heard them in court pleading to Judge Barry Williams that the police department has sabotaged. They used the word sabotage, the prosecution, that the police department had not turned over discovery in a timely fashion for them to turn it over to the defense. Now, as a defense attorney, obviously I'd be leaping for joy, but the reality is that justice is justice. And do we expect the Baltimore Police Department to put their papers together, to hand it over to the prosecutor, to prosecute one of their own? I think not. And so the fact that these officers get to benefit from their brethren, literally standing in the way of justice, is a travesty. But I do see, as we go forward with Lieutenant Brian Rice, the state attorney's office is taking a bit of a different spin in going forward, and they're putting their energy and they're putting their efforts on what they know they've already been able to move forward on these other cases. What we call facts beyond shame.
Okay.
Scott, I received a petition last night from your organization, Color of Change, asking me to sign this petition to urge the Department of Justice to bring charges in the deaths of Alton Sterling and Philando Castillo. But I think one of the things that, you know, frustrates those of us who have been active or covering the movement for Black lives is the pace of such investigations and really their effectiveness. Department of Justice investigations have not really yielded very much in terms of these Black Lives Matter cases, these killings. You know, there was a tremendous report out of the DOJ about Ferguson as a city. But I'm wondering, can the Department of Justice bring criminal charges or just civil rights charges? And that's something that's been happening in the past.
Right. Just to answer the question briefly and then elaborate, yes, they can bring criminal charges. And that's why I think the Alton Sterling killing is really...
Can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, I think the Alton Sterling case is really where we could see that. That case is very different. I don't think that there has, at least, you know, in this kind of post-Ferguson era, there hasn't been a case that the feds took over like they've done in Baton Rouge.
Hmm.
So as opposed to having their own separate investigation, as I understand, I know we got a lawyer on the phone, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but the FBI has taken over that investigation, and they can't bring federal murder charges, right? Not necessarily civil rights charges. What we have seen typically is, just as you said, civil rights investigations, and it's an incredibly high burden to prove that someone was killed because they were Black. I mean, they would basically have to say, you know, something extremely racist right before killing the person, right?
Right.
And that is very tough, and that's what we have not seen. I think the only case that we've seen post-Ferguson where we saw those kind of civil rights charges brought was the Walter Scott case, or that the feds prosecuted was the Walter Scott case. I'm not sure if those are federal criminal charges, which is the gentleman in North Charleston, South Carolina, that was shot in the back by the officer. Then the officer tried to point the gun. You know, it was maybe the most egregious video. I think the Alton Sterling video is right there with it. I think we could definitely see federal charges there. To your point, it's an extremely long process. And I think that is the point of the campaign we are starting with here. And we feel that we do need to respond first to these, to the killing. And then we must think about bigger systemic demands that we have to pivot to. Right. But we think these videos, especially the Alton Sterling video, is clear evidence of what's happened. Right. And the federal government does not need to be waiting. The point that I've been making to folks is, if you had me on video shooting someone and it was on the national news, I would already be in jail. We all know that. So we don't think that there should be a wait. We have had over 100,000 people sign the petition that you received. We have allied organizations similar to us, other online organizations, our kind of white progressive allies, have backed it up. And my assumption, I don't know the exact numbers, but somewhere around 200,000 folks nationally have signed this, if not more. So we're going to be soon, very soon, taking it to the Department of Justice and demanding charges right now. Like, we don't need a long, played-out investigation. But I do think the other thing is, yes, the type of investigation that we saw come out of Ferguson is what we call that principles and practices investigation, where they look at these departments specifically. Unfortunately, Baton Rouge has been through that process multiple times. They have been under a consent decree, which is an agreement between the Department of Justice and local police around changes that they would have to make to respect people's civil rights. They've been under one of those for decades. They were investigated following Katrina for police misconduct. So really, I think where we're going to is that the federal government really has to step up and really have consequences for these police departments. Just like we see these individual officers commit these acts of violence, and we don't see accountability. We're seeing the same thing with these departments. Cleveland, you know, everyone is, I think, pretty aware of Cleveland's disastrous track record with policing, the deaths of folks like Tamir Rice and Tanisha Anderson, yet the federal government has just given $50 million to Cleveland for public safety during the Republican National Convention. They're spending about $20 million of that on militarized gear.
You're raising a really important point, and it's kind of talking about what people are discussing now in terms of the next phase of the movement for Black
right.
lives and
right.
the types of remedies that people want to seek and how we can really make a change. And so I want to continue to talk to you about that. I'm speaking to Scott Roberts of Color of Change and LaToya Francis, civil rights attorney based in Baltimore, speaking to us today from Atlanta. But we're going to take a brief break right now, and we'll be right back.
Can't hold me down, there's no gravity in my universe. Those rules don't exist to me, you don't believe me, you can search. Feeling bittersweet, now it's cavities in your tooth that hurts. Cause it doesn't work when you're grabbing me, trying to pull me down. The earth backstabbing me as I prove my worth. If you bite in my style, then who was first? If you bite in my dust, then who was first? Geek down, trying to act wild, don't make it worse. I speak the truth when I spit, call it a naked verse. St. John, when I spit, let me take you to church. Amen, amen, trying to intimidate me, and you just amen. And you dealing with an ill Super Saiyan, with a wide vision and a game plan. Call that full brain, John Illa J. Yancey, that's my full name. Gray Bonds on steroids, that's my full swing. And I'm a ghetto superstar, spit stupid boss. Yeah.
That was Robert Glasper, They Can't Hold Me Down, featuring Illa J on the ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Avaram. I'm speaking to LaToya Francis, civil rights attorney, Scott Roberts of Color of Change, and I think joining me on the line is the Reverend Graylin Hagler, longtime veteran human rights activist here in D.C. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning. Good morning.
I wanted to bring you in to ask you about last night's town hall here in D.C. At the point that I was able to observe, there were people really kind of emoting and expressing their feelings. But what kind of actions do you think came out of last night's gathering?
Well, one of the things that came out of last night's gathering is just that there was a lot of emotion. People are very angry. People are trying to figure out what to do. How you continue to respond. And what we did out of the meeting was to create a steering committee that is going to come back to an overall meeting next Thursday night with a perspective and also a organizing agenda that people will be able to discuss and will be able to, in a sense, to frame and to move forward on. So that's one thing that's coming out of that, to really begin to produce some action in some strategic kinds of ways, because I think that the problem has been up until now is that we have gone off emotionally responding, and then that peters out until something else happens, and the issue becomes, can we create a very broad sector of our community that helps to organize and frame the kind of strategic actions that are going to be required to begin to address these issues and to change things.
And we're actually coming to the close of this segment, and I wanted to give LaToya Francis and also Scott Roberts a chance to talk about what actions they see necessary going forward, because certainly there's been such a visceral reaction across the country to these two deaths in particular because of, I think, the graphic video footage and the courage of the people shooting it and just the horrific circumstances of children, witnesses. So I'll go to you first, LaToya. I know you're working on brutality cases that don't have this video and media spotlight. And because of them, I mean, what are some of the concrete steps do you think that need to be taken? Earlier you talked about, you know, victims' rights and treating people with respect. But what else needs to be done?
So, and I'll certainly be brief. Legislative action is a must, but on the back end. As it stands right now, most police departments across this nation have general orders in place that says officers can't do X. The courts have addressed these issues when it comes to police brutality. We need to take action that commands the police department to hold the officers accountable. Administrative disciplinary action that is under cloak and covert and not transparent does absolutely nothing to change what's happening. You know, whenever we have instances of homicide and there are no charges brought, despite there being probable cause to bring charges, that will not garner change. So we need some type of legislative action that compels those persons in a position of power to take action, to literally take action. And just in wrapping it up, everyone is familiar with the law enforcement officers' bills of rights that vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, that literally protect these officers when they kill in cold blood. We have to do better as a community to either rewrite, tear down, or totally abort portions of these bills of rights that allow officers to not say anything for upwards of 10 days, not compelling them to answer questions, not compelling them to stand and provide information, allowing their information when it comes to other claims of excessive force to be considered personnel and privileged and private. That way, as a community, we have no idea how dangerous some of these people are that are watching our churches, our homes, our schools, our businesses. So at the very least, the legislative action needs to be had, but on the level where we are compelling those that must take action, where the law is already there to take action, that compels them to actually take the action.
You
if
know,
there is no one holding these officers accountable, that's the issue.
I do know that the Progressive Maryland and that broad coalition, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, also included in that coalition, they were very successful in bringing some legislative reform, some police reforms in Maryland this year, reducing that 10-day window that you just mentioned
right.
to 5 days, and putting a civilian on these review boards.
And how
helpful do you think that reform is?
It's a step. It is, I believe, it's extremely helpful. But the angle that I'm addressing, second to that, is we still have to get at the commissioner. We still have to figure out why education and training isn't training some of these officers. We still have to figure out why they only, for example, Baltimore Police Department, are only required to test when it comes to carrying their firearm once a year and not even twice a year like the feds do. We still have to figure out why these supervisors circle the wagon around officers and refuse to take them off the street when they know the dangers that they are to the community. So addressing the individual officer is a must. We understand that. But addressing the supervisors and the superior officers that are in control of the personnel files, that are in control of the education and training, that are in control of the information that protects us as a community, we have to address that head on. And if we don't, there will be no change. There will simply be more acquiescing to the bad behavior and more bodies and more black men killed like dogs in the street. That's all we'll have if we don't have that type of change.
Now, Scott Roberts, I was listening to Reverend Hagler talk about people meeting last night and organizing a steering committee here in D.C. And when I heard that, you know, because I was at the meeting, it makes me wonder how much these kind of new groupings are going to connect into the existing movement for Black Lives. There's been a lot of organizing. There's been a lot of infrastructure created in the last, you know, in the recent years since even the murder of Trayvon Martin. And I'm wondering how Color of Change and other organizations that have been on the ground can connect with these kind of new groupings of people who are just outraged this week and want to do something.
Well, I am so glad you asked that question. This is kind of some of the closing points that I wanted to make. I totally agree that we have to understand that we're in a different place than we were 2 years ago. And we have to be able to tell that story, too. I think, you know, there's a lot more infrastructure that has been built. Some new organizations have emerged and now have national voices. We understand our strategy better. I think we understand what we want better. For instance, and this goes to the point of how folks can connect. You know, even before this was planned, I you mentioned the Movement for Black Lives. I sit in a working group around policy, and there are more than 40 organizations, some of the newer groups that emerged, some of the older groups that have been in the Black freedom struggle for decades, at the table together developing a policy agenda. When Ferguson happened, I know as somebody who, as you said, after Trayvon Martin, I was in the Capitol with the Dream Defenders for that takeover. I ended up on the ground in Ferguson, but in that moment after Ferguson, you know, there was a scramble. What is it that our community wants? And we ended up getting caught up in some of the hot kind of, not necessarily the movement, but certainly our leadership opted to invest in, you know, kind of shiny new stuff, body cameras, predictive policing software. We saw that even from our own mayor here in D.C., right? But now I think the movement is really positioned to articulate the kind of demands that we want. I encourage folks in a, I think within the next 3 weeks, you're going to see the launch of the Movement for Black Lives policy platform. It's going to be in dialogue with what the two parties are putting out. So I think in terms of when we're looking for what to do, what to call for, understanding that there have been folks who've taken over a year-long process to start developing those things so and try to create resources for local organizers.
Okay.
The Color of Change, folks can definitely reach out to us. Our website is colorofchange.org. I think for, you know, the last thing I want to say is that, like, you know, we are, and for folks who want to join us in this work, I'd be really excited. We see like basically two ways that we need to intervene in this moment, and that is going after decision makers, those folks who made those decisions to double down on investing in policing, body cameras, buying into these notions that the protests are violent, things of that nature. And then the opposition, like, who are the folks who are actually benefiting from all of this? And that's police departments,
okay,
police unions, folks like that. So glad to hear this discussion around the Law Enforcement Office Bill of Rights. We need to challenge those folks on the things that they're pushing forward. So we continue to want to be helpful. We want to help the organizing in D.C. I know a lot of the local organizers, but Reverend Hagler, love to connect with you. And again,
okay,
Thank you for having me on to talk about this issue. Appreciate it.
Okay, and thank you. I've been speaking to LaToya Francis, a civil rights attorney based in Baltimore, the Reverend Graylin Hagler, veteran activist here in D.C., and pastor of Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, which hosted the town hall last night, which was originally developed by one of our programmers here, Cleveland Spears, and also Scott Roberts, an organizer with Color of Change, which has been active in the movement for Black Lives. Thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you.
When we come
Thanks
back... preparing the next generation to take on these legal fights for human rights. Stay with us. That was Robert Glasper again on the ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam. Well, the Charles Hamilton Houston Law Preparatory Institute, which provides an intensive training for students entering law school, holds a memorial lecture each year. This year's speaker was attorney Nkechi Taifa, Advocacy Director for Criminal Justice at the Open Society Foundation and founder convener of the Justice Roundtable Coalition. Here is a portion of her remarks on the criminal justice system and mass incarceration, May June 30th at the Georgetown University Law Center.
Policies and practices reflect subtle and insidious racism. I want to give an example. In 1987, there was this former Philadelphia DA, Jack McMahon, who developed a training video, Judge Simmons, on how to select a jury. And in the tape, McMahon, who was an assistant DA at the time, he directed his rookie prosecutors to circumvent the law by denying certain citizens the chance to serve on a jury by favoring others. And I'm quoting, he said, the only way to do your best is to get jurors that are as unfair and more likely to convict than anybody else in this room. That's on the training video. He taught that jurors who were especially quote-unquote bad included ladies, young black women, and low-income blacks. Prosecutors had to kick them off juries, he said, without the appearance of violating the law. And you know what? Appearances matter. Because we as lawyers know, in 1986, in an attempt to introduce more fairness in the criminal justice system, the Supreme Court ruled that lawyers could no longer strike potential jurors because of their race. And although McMahon was only one prosecutor in one city, his jury selection training methods were institutionalized throughout his office. And according to him, were accepted principles representative of practices, quote, of the wisdom of the ages. So regardless of whether they disagree with his approach, new prosecutors could be out of a job if they failed to follow the cultural norms. McMahon's tactics were not isolated to the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Racism was structurally embedded in prosecutorial offices throughout the country, possibly impacting the outcome of countless cases. The long-range implications of what is increasingly becoming what Charcy McIntyre characterized as the criminalization of a race are shuddering. Massive incarceration with lengthy sentences invariably results in the disruption and disintegration of families, destabilization of communities, and diminished life prospects. Measures which combine to incarcerate generations, resulting in incalculable damages. Any consideration of the impact of mass incarceration that fails to take into account the role of institutionalized racism is an insufficient analysis. And any remedy that does not acknowledge the understanding that racism manifests in various forms is deficient. It is past time that we confront the disastrous policies of the past half century. This country's mammoth experiment in mass incarceration has been an abysmal failure. Kudos to Michelle Alexander for popularizing the analogy of today's system of mass incarceration with earlier systems of social control, such as Jim Crow. Yes, we are talking about the institutionalization of second-class citizenship once one is released from imprisonment. Yes, we are talking about disparate treatment and profiling, arrest, and sentencing, but we may also be talking about the possible extermination of generations as well. Unfortunately, my elderly neighbor, Dakari, Miss Pearl, passed before I could tell her about my work and the successful passage of the Second Chance Reentry legislation. She passed before I could tell her that the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 that I've been working on for 17 years finally became law, which reduced the 100-to-1 ratio between crack and powder cocaine. She didn't get a whiff of the winds of change on the horizon. She didn't know that the narrative on crime was shifting and that criminal justice reform was not the lightning rod it was decades earlier. She missed the 2012 Supreme Court ruling Tsuji and Miller, which held that mandatory life without parole sentences for children violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. She didn't know that the litany of Supreme Court cases in this area, Ron, looked to international law to support its conclusions. Ms. Pearl didn't get to hear that former Attorney General Holder's smart on crime policies focused federal prosecutions on large-scale traffickers rather than bit players. She didn't know that President Obama would be the first sitting president to visit a federal prison and starred in a documentary about it. She didn't know about his executive clemency initiative, which I'm helping to mobilize to provide relief for those serving the inordinately lengthy mandatory minimum sentences. She wasn't around for the bipartisan Senate introduction of perhaps the most comprehensive, progressive federal criminal justice legislation in a generation. And she would be shocked to hear of working alliances between the Koch brothers and the ACLU and Van Jones and Newt Gingrich. It's a new day, people, and a new narrative is being formed. But although Ms. Pearl didn't witness the dawning of this new day and is unable to shape this new narrative, you and I, CHH scholars, can. We are now at a point where we can openly discuss the data that we have all known for years that sending people to prison and keeping them there for unconscionably lengthy periods of time does not make us any safer, does not deter future crimes, and does not promote successful reintegration back into our communities. Future lawyers, CHH scholars, we need to find better, more creative and more cost-effective ways to push the envelope to achieve change. Future lawyers, CHH scholars, we need to raise the ante and have the audacity to advance creative solutions. The Miss Pearls of our community are crying out for you to take your place in continuing the struggle. So in concluding, I want to take just a moment to embellish upon a story Malcolm X often related about two types of enslaved people out there on the plantation back in the day, which he described as the house slave and the field slave. How many of y'all are familiar with that speech? I don't know, the house slave. Okay. In some, he told us that the house slave lived up there in the big house with Massa. Actually, it's in the attic or in the basement, but it was in the big house nevertheless. He ate the same food that Massa ate, or at least it was the scraps from the crumbs that Massa left, but he was satisfied with that. If Massa got sick, he said, what? What's the matter, Massa? We sick? If Massa's house caught fire, he fought harder than Massa to put it out. Now the field slave. Malcolm said that he worked in the field from sun up to sundown. He lived in a shack, if that, wore gunny sacks for clothes. When Massa got sick, field slave, he prayed that he wouldn't recover. When Massa's house caught fire, he what? He prayed for that strong wind. But you know what? Malcolm didn't mention another one who was out there on that plantation, the yard hand. You see, the yard hand came from the field, but by hook and crook, he succeeded in getting away from it. Now, the yard hand didn't live in the big house, but she didn't live too far away from it. She was close enough to just look in, peek in. Sometimes got so close, she couldn't even sneak right in, Obama. Okay. Now, she didn't live too far from the field either. She could hear the whip of the lash and remember this thing. You see, the yard hand could see what was happening up in the big house. And she could see what was happening in the field. You see, because of this unique position, she often had a choice as to what her position was going to be. Was she going to work in the interest of her people? Check out Sonia Sotomayor's brilliant dissent in the recent Fourth Amendment case. Was she going to work in the interest of her people? Or was she going to work against those entrants, Clarence Thomas, who essentially flushed the exclusionary rule down the toilet last week? CHH preparatory law students, the choice the yard hand had yesterday is the exact choice that you, as future lawyers of color, have today. You have the choice to work against your best interests, or you have the choice to actively promote justice. And this choice is present. Whether your future practice takes you to the apex of the most lucrative law firm in the country or to the most modest legal service provider organization, no matter where your career path takes you, you have the responsibility to put the research, the writing, and the advocacy skills you are learning in the Charles Hamilton Houston Preparatory Law Institute to struggle against injustice in society and to reach back into the community to assist those who never made it out of the field. I would love for you to go into public interest law, but I also would love for you to be a judge. I would love for you to be a prosecutor. I would love for you to be a legislator. I would love for you to be a partner in a huge law firm. Why? Because you might be that judge to finally set Sundiata Okoli and Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rushia McGee free. You might be that prosecutor who uses her discretion wisely. You might be that legislator who abolishes mandatory minimum penalties. You might be the governor to grant clemency to Asante Shakur. You might be that law firm partner who finances the posting of bail for any Black Lives Matter protester to get out of jail. Perhaps the great orator Frederick Douglass put it best back in 1857 when he explained that the whole progress of human liberty shows that all concessions have been born of what? Of earnest struggle. He said, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess the favor of freedom yet depreciate agitation are those who want the crops without plowing up the ground. They want the rain without the thunder and the lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its mighty waters. Frederick Douglass said it over 150 years ago, and it still rings strong today, Jordan. Power concedes nothing without a demand in the struggle for justice. It never did and it never will. And that is what I feel being a public interest lawyer, a movement lawyer, a people's lawyer is all about. Picking up that baton from our predecessors and demanding power in our joint struggle for justice. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Attorney Nkechi Taifa, Advocacy Director for Criminal Justice at the Open Society Foundation and Founder Convener of the Justice Roundtable. That was a portion of her address on the criminal justice system and mass incarceration made June 30th at the Georgetown University Law Center, the annual Charles Hamilton Houston Memorial Lecture. And that will do it for us on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Thanks again to the Reverend Graylin Hagler, Attorney Latoya Francis, and Scott Roberts of Color of Change. And thanks to our engineer today, Katia Stitt. Thank you so much for joining us at the end of this week when we have all witnessed so much as a mass, but also as individuals, the snuffing out of lives. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Avaram. Raise your voice. Peace.